Right now, Gemma Tarlak is back with us for a look at some of the most intriguing stories in the world of science, including male birth control, the quest for new non-addictive pain relievers, and a continent splitting apart at the seams. Possibly. Gemma is a senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. Gemma, welcome back to Central Time.
Hello and happy science to you.
Well, yeah, to you too. And let's start, Gemma, by talking about birth control. And when we think about birth control for men, there are a lot fewer options than there are for women. Why is that?
Well, it's a number of reasons. But, you know, one of the things is, I mean, well, men basically have the choice between a condom or a vasectomy, whereas women have all different kinds of options in terms of everything from surgery to oral medications and everything in between. And part of that is it can be very dangerous for a woman to be pregnant. So a lot of times doctors are looking for other ways, researchers are looking for other ways to make sure that women can have better control over their reproduction. And, you know, I mean, let's face it, with guys don't face that same issue. So basically, a lot of it has just been led by the need, where the need is greatest. But there are some other factors as well, in that several trials with several different potential male contraceptives have run into all different kinds of difficulties.
And the first one actually detailed in a Discover Magazine article involves taking a really, really deadly poison and using it as a male birth control after tweaking it a bit. But, you know, that tell us about that one. It seems a little disturbing
sure.
At first blush.
Sure. Well, I want to back up a little bit because that particular approach, it involves a poison called Huabane, and that particular approach has not advanced to human trials yet. So they haven't tried it in any people yet. So don't worry, guys. It's not an issue. But it has a really fascinating history to it because Huabane is actually a substance that is used in some areas of Africa, especially in the East. It's used as a poison because in its natural form, it's kind of a heart-stopping compound. And it works by disrupting a critical process that the cells exchange material. It's basically a way that the cells nourish themselves and keep going. And this protein, this compound, disturbs that process in heart cell muscles. And so the researchers took this compound and they engineered it. They just tweaked it a little bit so that it's not going to stop your heart, but it does disrupt that critical protein in sperm instead. And it's very early in the research. I want to stress that we are years and years and years away from human trials if they ever happen. But so far, it looks pretty promising in the lab in terms of just stopping sperm.
Can you talk about some of the other male contraceptive methods that are maybe in the works and some of the challenges they face?
Sure. Well, you know, there is a lot of work looking at testosterone and how a potential gel that's actually entering a very large-scale human trial this summer, a testosterone-based gel, might work. Kind of similar idea to the way oral contraceptives work for women, but there are a lot of other compounds out there that are being tested or have been tested that have nothing to do with testosterone and other sex hormones. And there are things, for example, there's one compound that successfully disrupts and stops production of an acid that is critical in sperm production. So that sounds really good. That sounds super great. But if you have this compound in your system and you drink alcohol, it's going to make you super, super sick. So there are lots of things where the compound looks really good, the method looks really good, and then they get to a certain point in the research and they realize, oh, there's this problem. You know, one of the problems, for example, with a lot of the testosterone potential contraceptives that have been tried is that they only work on 8 or 9 out of 10 men. And that becomes an issue, obviously, because if you're going to be taking this, you want a failure rate. You want a failure rate that's smaller than the average condom use, which is at about 90%. I should say a 10% failure rate, not a 90% failure rate. But all different approaches, and it's really an interesting field that I think is just in the past couple of years taking off, just in terms of people looking for better alternatives for men.
But we shouldn't be looking for these coming to a doctor's office near us in the short term future, right?
Yeah, probably they're all at least a few years off. Some of them, for example, that large-scale testosterone gel study that I mentioned that's underway, this is the at least the second human trial of this. It's the first large-scale one. And if those results are promising, then you could expect that to gain even more momentum and probably be the first thing on the market. But again, a lot of hurdles to jump.
Talking to Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine, checking out some of the most interesting stories in the world of science. Let's turn to another effort to develop a medicine, Gemma. We've got this opioid addiction problem. We talk about it a lot on the show. And the medical community is trying to figure out pain-relieving medications, still sometimes based on opioid drugs, that would not have the addictive potential. Talk about the importance, first of all, of coming up with something like this.
Yeah, well first I want to say this is opioid addiction and opioid overdose deaths in our country and in other countries as well. It's such a huge issue right now, and it's also an extremely complex issue. So, but when you look at the numbers, I mean, it's just absolutely, it takes your breath away. In 2016, more than 42,000 people just in America died because of opioid overdose, and at least 2 million Americans are dealing with opioid prescription opioid addiction. I want to stress prescription because there's also the street drugs as well. And, you know, they estimate that of the people prescribed opioids for chronic pain, about a quarter of them, a quarter to a third, are going to misuse them. So it is a huge issue that is touching just millions of people. And, you know, there's been a lot of talk about how to address it politically and socioeconomically and all those factors. But our contributing editor, Jonathan Keats, went to the researchers who are on the front lines of figuring out, as they put it, how to make an opioid that kills the pain without killing the patient. And they really have to start from scratch and create these brand new approaches to pain killing. So it's very exciting, and there's been some very, very cool developments, but we're still a ways off. Like with male contraception, we're still a ways off from having that the drug on the shelf that's going to help people with chronic pain without creating all these horrible problems with addiction.
And it gets really complicated because it turns out pain and how we feel pain is really complicated, right? Can you talk a little bit about the science between pain and how these opioid medications work?
Sure, sure. And I want to stress that the approaches that we cover in the magazine, they're all very different approaches. But basically, your body is full of opioid receptors. For a long time, researchers thought that only the brain and central nervous system had these opioid receptors. But a few decades ago, and we talked to one of the researchers who discovered this, we found out that there are all these peripheral opioid receptors that are outside of the brain. And this particular research, Christoph Stein, he actually figured out a way that inflammation plays a role. Like if you break your leg, let's say, the tissue around that break is going to get super inflamed, and the opioid receptors, the peripheral opioid receptors around that leg, are going to register that inflammation. So he is looking at developing an opioid alternative that would only target areas that have that level of inflammation. So the opioid would go to work and would kill the pain you have because you just broke your leg, but it wouldn't even get into your brain. It would stay out of your brain because it only works in areas where the acidity is actually higher than the natural acidity you find in the brain. So that's, for example, and I just want to stress that I have super simplified some very complicated work, but Jonathan breaks it down really well in our cover story, this issue, if you're interested in the topic. And that's just one approach. Again, using inflammation as a kind of roadmap for the painkiller, like, hey, go over here, don't go there to the brain. But, you know, sometimes painkillers do get to the brain, and that's why another scientist is working on looking at how the release of dopamine in the brain by an opioid can create this cascade effect and lead to addiction and other issues. And, you know, dopamine, I'm sure folks know that it's a neurotransmitter and that it basically helps the neurons talk to each other. And one of the things dopamine does is it reinforces behavior. It's kind of the reward system of the brain. And what happens with opioids is they hijack that natural reward system and really lead the brain to just crave more and more and more and more. And that's one of one of the issues with addiction. So basically, this researcher, Edward Bilski, is really looking at how we can disrupt that dopamine function in terms of hijacking the reward system, but without disrupting all the other things dopamine does, because it does a lot of things. In addition to helping the neurons talk to each other, it's involved in a lot of different just physiological crucial functions. So he's looking at a way to kind of stop the hijacking and let dopamine do the things that it needs to do without letting the opioids kind of force the person into addiction. So that's another really exciting angle.
And I want to switch gears for our last minute or so. Gemma, continental drift and the formation of new continents, we think that happens over tens of thousands of years, and it does, but we're seeing signs of it maybe happening in Africa in real time?
Well, yeah, you know, we've known for years, for ever since pretty much plate tectonics was a thing, for at least the last half century, we've known that the African Rift Valley, which is basically between the Red Sea and Somalia, Ethiopia, Eritrea, down into Kenya, we've known that it's splitting apart. The continent is kind of being pulled apart by the underlying plate tectonics. And for a long time, that was the textbook. Hey, it's splitting apart. But now geologists are realizing, wait a minute, it's not splitting apart the way we thought it was. And that may mean that it's not actually going to split apart, that it may actually kind of heal itself. So our writer followed a geologist around, and she's tracking this in field stations. And it's fascinating, and it's just a really beautiful part of the continent of Africa as well. So there's a lot of just really beautiful visuals and wonderful people in the story.
And briefly, Gemma, this may have happened from Lake Superior to Kansas in the distant past, right? It looked like it was going to break apart. It kind of welded itself back together.
Yeah, absolutely. That rift, in fact, you can see it even in parts of Wisconsin. There are little bits of it left, but it basically looked like, if you can imagine North America just getting ripped apart right across the middle, it looked like that was going to happen, but then it stopped. And that is something geologists have always struggled to understand, and they may actually be able to use what's happening in Africa now to inform their understanding of what happened billions of years ago right here in our backyard.
Good place to leave it. Gemma, thanks as always for joining us.
Thank you. Have a good day.
That's Gemma Tarlak. She's a senior editor at Discover Magazine. She joins us once a month with some of the most intriguing stories from the world of science. There's more to come here on Central Time.